If you're thinking about it, she's talking about it. Join the conversation at 203-333-9422. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600.
So in this conversation in which some people are dipping their toes, some people are running to the other side of the pool, some people are wading right into the ocean, and we're talking about a conversation in race relations. Joining us right now are two guests who've spent an awful lot of time thinking about this, lecturing about it, and talking about it. Marguerite Pennock Parks, PhD, is a teacher, and she says in her bio that her teaching is rooted in years of scholarship in multicultural literature, white privilege, and social justice, which she is passionate about. She is a 2016 recipient of the Oshkosh Bagosh Endowed Professorship at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. And she's earned a bunch of different degrees, including a doctorate in curriculum and supervision from the University of Iowa. She co-edited books that have titles like this, A Guide for White Women Teaching Black Boys, Everyday White People Confront Racial and Social Injustice. And with her is Debbie Irving, who was a white woman who claims that a course at Wheelock College in 2009 called Racial and Cultural Identity, quote, shook me awake with the realization that I'd missed examining the way being a member of the quote-unquote normal race had interfered with my attempts to understand racism. I flagged that in particular because Wheelock College is a college where my mother-in-law was the dean of admissions for many years and ultimately became a vice president of enrollment management. Our family has deep and very, very affectionate ties to Wheelock College. And so Debbie Irving and Marguerite Pennock Parks have written something called Tell Me What to Do, a 21-day racial equity habit-building challenge. And we're going to hear about it. So good morning, Debbie. And good morning, Marguerite, or I can call you Miss Irving and Miss Pennock Park, Dr. Pennock Parks. How would you prefer I address you on the air? I have no problem please either one.
Please call me Debbie, and thanks for having me on.
A pleasure, Debbie. Yes.
I was just going to say, please call me Marguerite, and also thank you for having us on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Good. Great. I'm Lisa. All right. So, first of all, Debbie, isn't that very cool about Wheelock College and my mother-in-law, by the way? Just had a
By the way, that course I took was mandatory, and I don't think many colleges at the point I was taking that were having that kind of boldness. So Wheelock's bold.
Yeah, they've just been subsumed into, is it Simmons, I think? No, BU. Pardon me, BU. My mother-in-law would kill me. BU. BU just took, but they're going to keep the name Wheelock. It's going to become the Wheelock College of Education at Boston University. After all those years, they couldn't make it anymore on their own. But it's a great, great school. Great school. So, all right. So, Debbie, let me begin with you. You're a white woman. And tell me a little bit about your journey into making this your academic area of specialty and your passion.
Sure. And before we go any further, I want to just acknowledge that the person who came up with the idea for the 21-day racial equity habit building challenge was actually a good friend and colleague of Marguerite's and mine, Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. He's a black man who founded the White Privilege Conference 21 years ago. Talk about bold. When everyone was telling him he couldn't name it that because no one would come. Cut to 21 years later and thousands of people attended. And that was part, it was both the Wheelock College and then it was through attending the White Privilege Conference that I really started to understand that I had been fed myths my whole life about the history of the United States. And by the way, I was a history major in college. And the more I started to understand a truer history, a fuller, more widely perspective history, the more I realized as I started talking to people in my own personal circles, white people, that this was a pervasive problem, that there is an epidemic of white ignorance across the country. And we may be good, well-intentioned people. And if we're not operating on facts and we don't know our own history, we are really set up to do a lot of harm. So that's how I got into this.
So let me ask you something, Debbie. Do you think that it is that white people have been fed? You said you used the word myths. Do you think that it is mm-hmm. that white people are getting the wrong information, or they're just not getting enough information to have everything in context?
Both. And I think that we are getting incredibly limited information, and much of that limited information is wrong. And I'm talking about in schools, too.
Okay, and it continues give me some today. Examples. You're a teacher. Tell me some examples.
The example is I was told that the Indians, that's the language I was taught, died of disease. And never spoken about was the fact that there was a full-on growing government-led, but before the United States government, a colonizer-led genocide against indigenous people. It was very intentional. The land in this country, I was also taught that the people living here were just sort of running around, savages, uncivilized, and that's not true. This is a highly civilized continent, Central South America, what's now the United States, Canada. It was very much populated. There were millions of people here, with commerce and laws and thriving. And that land was needed. And so it was a full-on genocide. To extirpate was the word that was used in documentation. That's like pulling a plant out by its root. To extirpate indigenous people to make that land available, because this was a wealth and nation-building power project, and so that land was needed. So that's an example.
And was that Spain well before Britain and the Pilgrims and Plymouth Rock, or is that at the same time? Who was doing that, and in what manner was it doing that, and how do you know that to be true?
Well, because there's no shortage of documentation. So you can go back to the Papal Bulls, look at Portugal and Spain. And then it was just the European, that was colonization, imperialism, all of that was happening, much of it entangled with Christianity, the tame the heathens. And really it was about exploiting resources. And so this land that we now call the United States was one more land to be exploited. And the difference here is that Imperialists and colonizers didn't just come in to extract goods and resources for wealth. They took over the land. So we use the term colonial settlers because they settled here. And it's important to know that indigenous people did not all get killed. They are very much still here with a growing voice, growing in number and growing in voice. In fact, we have a new plan coming out today, a 21-day plan that focuses on indigenous issues specifically.
Wow. Okay, so that's a lot. So, Marguerite, thank you very much for waiting so patiently. I wanted to hear what Debbie Irving had to say. So Marguerite, your emphasis and focus, are you a black woman?
No, I'm not. I'm a white woman.
You're a white woman. Okay. So your emphasis and focus, at least from what I can see in your bio, has also been very much about white privilege and social justice. And how did you come to have that be the area that you cared so much about?
As I'm listening to Debbie's story, and I've read Debbie's book, both of us grew up in one way very similar, middle-class white. But I grew up in a middle-class white family in the South who talked about race all the time because it was the civil rights movement. And I say that because I want to be certain that people understand how important that is. So, I remember watching the black and white videos of the riots and all of that, and my parents talking to me about that. I was in North Carolina. So I think I've always grown up around discussions of inequities and privilege. And my parents were very big news watchers and discussers and lecturers. My father was. And then I ended up teaching in an urban school in Kansas City, high school, English drama, debate, and forensics. And I think that's when the systemic issues that surround race and equity really struck me, because what my students didn't have and what other students in other school districts did have was enormous. One of the examples I give is I was the high school debate coach, and my budget for the entire high school debate season was $500. And we were competing against school districts with $10,000 budgets just for the debate team. And so that's when I really started, and the majority of my students were African-Americans from what we call the contingency zone. Other people would call it the ghetto. We call it the contingency zone. And the inequities that my students faced in striving to overcome so that they could go to college were enormous. And that's when I really started to realize that we needed to do more than just teach students multicultural education, that we needed to teach teachers to be active and engaged and understand the systems that provide an equitable, don't provide an equitable education, where some people get a great education and other people are really floundering with books that are old, with, you know, equipment. My students had a file cabinet full of debate notes, and other people walked in with, you know, stacks of them because they'd gone to camp and their parents had paid for their camp or the school had paid for their camp.
So let me ask you,
that's when I really realized the inequities.
Yeah, I can see that. And did you come to believe that, given the status quo of the inequities, who did you think was to blame for that? Like, where did you apportion or assign blame?
The reason I went to get my master's from Madison is because I needed to understand the system. And once I understood the system, I wanted to work to change teachers. Our educational system is built in a white European model of education. It goes back to Prussia. And when we look at that method of teaching and how it is done, it benefits some people and it doesn't benefit others. I mean, the system is built to keep people where they are. And the educational system is built to teach the way white people like to teach. And as Debbie said, to teach the stuff we're comfortable teaching. Because I have teachers who will read multicultural books in their classrooms and actually say, I was shaking and blushing because I'm so uncomfortable doing this. Well, if they're uncomfortable reading a multicultural book, then how do they think their black children or their students of members of the black indigenous people of color group feel sitting in the classroom when all they're hearing about is white?
So what do you mean? What's a multicultural book versus a white book? I'm really not understanding what you mean by that. What would be so qualitatively different or make somebody embarrassed reading a book by a black author or an Asian author or something like that? Well, missing something.
It will depend on the content of the book. There's some books that it wouldn't, like Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats. It's just a beautiful picture of a black boy playing the snow, or Jacob Jumps. But then there are other books that address race. The Other Side by Jacqueline Woodson very much is about racial inequalities and why black and white kids don't play together.
I see.
So it depends on the content of the book.
Interesting. So you guys together were chatting with Debbie Irving and Marguerite Pennett Parks. You guys have devised, with Eddie Moore, who's not with us, Dr. Eddie Moore, something called the 21-Day Racial Equity Habit Building Challenge. And so I'll let you start, Marguerite, with a little bit of that. Who is this aimed at? And give me an example, if you can, very concrete, of some of the exercises you're asking people to do.
I'm going to throw that question to Debbie, because Debbie and Eddie really created this and then brought me on.
Okay. Go ahead, Debbie.
Yeah. So we realized that Dr. Moore and I both spend a lot of time doing workshops and trainings with groups of people, and a lot of it in schools and also in nonprofits. And at the end of our workshops, often people would say, well, I'm starting to understand the problem, but tell me what to do. And we, you know, he turned to me at one point and said, we have to give them something to do. And he said, how about we create a quick 21-day curriculum? Like, anyone can do something for once a day for 21 days. And so that was the seed of it. And what we decided to do, teachers really love to access multiple parts of learners' brains, use all the senses. And so we asked people to do one thing a day for 21 days. And the thing might be an article that you read. It could be a podcast that you listen to. It could be a short video that you watch. It could be a full length movie that you watch. It could be taking our list of things to notice and go out in the world and start actually changing your racial lens, starting to see what too often becomes invisible just through being normalized. You might go on your social media or go onto some websites and connect with some new organizations that you've never heard of. And you take action. You might invite friends into this with you, friends or family into it. We've got all kinds of examples of actions. And we even have a playlist, music, to keep you inspired while you do this. And we have a cool little tracking tool because it is important when we do this big change work that we reflect daily. That really helps internalize what we're learning. So that's what it is.
Do you think let me ask you this, Debbie and Marguerite. You know, there's an assumption that underlays, it seems to me, a lot of what I'm reading and hearing, that with these exercises that are designed to make you see another person's point of view, enable, as you said, to see something through a different lens, that there will be some kind of recognition or understanding that the world isn't fair, that we've been fed myths, but it's also still possible that even in doing all of this, that one can still come away with a political viewpoint that says that there are still a lot of takeaways of individual agency as distinct from systemic prejudice. And I'm just curious as to your response to that. Marguerite, I'll let you go first. In other words,
go
ahead. Yeah.
What I know is that I use this exercise in my graduate class for my students, and most of them are going to be principals, but not all of them. And what I know from this is that, now I teach now in the Midwest, is that they enter the 21-day action plan not knowing how much they don't know, not recognizing how much they don't know. And with trepidation, because okay, they're like, I'm going to be able to find this much stuff, because, and it's like, okay. But what I also know is almost every student, if not every student who's participated in this exercise, says it's one of the best things that they have ever done to expose them to things. And as Debbie said, that action piece is so important, to learn to take action, that when they see things, they leave saying, okay, now I get it. And to a point, almost every person I've talked to who has ever participated in this project has said it's been transformational.
Transformational. Mm-hmm. That's the word, huh? Transformational.
Yeah.
What about you,
exactly,
Debbie? You think so as well? You think so also? Well, you know, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, no, we see this all the time. I mean, at this point, we really sort of lost track of how many people are doing it. I think, you know, if you Google 21-day racial equity habit building challenge, you'll get millions of hits. So, I mean, the entire American Bar Association is doing it. Entire towns do it. Schools do it. Corporations do it. And people are adapting it and turning it into, you know, changing out some of our podcasts and articles for podcasts and articles that might be more relevant to the healthcare sector if it's a hospital doing it, or the Midwest, if it's a Midwest group. So people localize it and narrow it down by sector. The thing is that if you were to say, tell me a good book to read about racism, we could suggest a bunch of books. That's going to take you about a month to get through it. The beauty of this is that in 21 days, you've probably heard from 21 different people who are out doing the kind of work Marguerite and I are doing. You're hearing from voices across age, class, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, did I say race? You know, just it's multiple perspectives through multiple modalities. And the hope is that on day 22, you don't go, phew, that's over. You say, wow, like, let's keep going. Now I know all these new cool people that I've heard from and these new radio shows and podcasts and sites, I'm going to keep going. So it's meant to be a kind of a launcher or maybe a deepener, a momentum builder. And in terms of different political framing, I mean, I think the truth really has no agenda. So people can do this, and they can integrate what they learn into their current political framework. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you still believe in small government, then you still believe in small government. This may or may not change that. But now at least you've got something, you've got some new information, because in the current social media landscape, the media landscape, it is so easy for us, given how many ways we can consume media, to put ourselves into an echo chamber and hear again and again and again.
True.
Yeah, from people who, so our perspectives have gotten narrower and narrower. So one of the impacts of this is that it will broaden your perspective in a quick 3 weeks.
It assumes that, and this is directed at white people, right? Because that's the audience for this, correct?
I think
it's directed at anybody.
Yeah.
Well, it's anybody, but you really, if you're trying to transform one point of view, you're not, I mean, it just sounds like it's directed at white people, because white people, beginning at the beginning of this conversation, in your view, have been fed a certain kind of information with certain kinds of authorship. And it's your view that it would be most transformative and worthwhile for white people to get a multicultural view. Isn't that where we are?
I think one of the ways it's most transformative is doing it in a group, and the more diverse the group, the better, where you have discussions. Because really, for me, that's one of the critical points of this, is that it opens discussions so that people can talk and agree or disagree. So doing it in isolation is not. That's why these groups are taking it on. So that they can do it together and talk about it and learn from each other and debrief together and deconstruct what it is that they've read.
I gotcha. Debbie Irving and Marguerite Pennett Parks, thank you very much. It's called the 21-Day Racial Equity Habit Building Challenge. That's a mouthful. But I guess if you just Google Racial Equity Challenge, it'll come right up. And thank you very much, ladies, for being on the show with us today. And all of it. It's all part of what we're doing on our show, which is continuing to have the conversation. So thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us on.
It's a pleasure. We'll be right back.